The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One. Don't forget to download our new Podcast One app.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
Put your name on it. Just put your name on it. That's all I say. Be a man or a woman. Put your name on it.
Well, I'd like to hear about it, pothead.
Look at the game change.
If you want to battle, it's either that you will or you won't.
You know, you're not a bad looking man, Mr. Gals.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Bullshit. You didn't convince me. Let me see your real war face.
No, I thought you said that you are right, Spider.
Hey, man.
Erica Garza wrote a great book, Getting Off. I ordered like literally 14 books from Podcast One, and only yours came through. And my nanny, Teresa, opened it. She's like, oh, this came for you? Just lost in translation, I suppose. She handed it to me like it was wet. It's an incredible book, and it's really a fascinating story, and I'm in recovery. And what fascinated me about your book, I can't imagine like people that are like, oh, I go to the step meeting on Tuesdays, and there's like overeater anonymous people there and stuff. Like, to have your addiction be a primal urge has to be confounding. Thirst, hunger, sex are the three primal urges. So I can't imagine having one of those addictions be one of those three. It seems... the journey that you had to go through, I can't comprehend. Like, nobody needs to drink booze or eat Vicodin to, like, sustain a civilization. But, like, to actually make love or have sex is something to sustain your species. I mean, I don't know how you did it, but you did it. Can you speak on how difficult that was? Because I'm talking a lot right now, but I want to let the listeners in a little bit, and they need to buy this book. I put my name on it, Erica Garza, Getting Off, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction. There's the awareness that you have a problem years sometimes before the action takes place to change. How long was it before, in between the awareness and the action for you?
The awareness wasn't something that happened overnight, for sure. I mean, it was something that I had a gradual realization about as I sabotaged yet another relationship, as I found myself binging on porn for longer periods of time. So it was something that I knew for a long time, especially throughout my 20s, that I had a big problem with, and that my happiness was really being affected by that. And I was feeling really stuck and lonely. And I just wasn't ready to face it at that point. And I didn't even know where to get help for this sort of thing. And I think that that's the problem for a lot of sex addicts, but especially for a lot of women who are sex addicts or porn addicts, because there's another layer of shame attached to being a woman and having a lot of sex or, you know, watching a lot of porn. And I always thought that Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meetings were something for men. You know, sex addiction was something that happened to men. And so I thought I should just shut up about it and keep it to myself. But I don't think that anything fuels addiction more than silence and that kind of shame and feeling like you're more broken than anybody else. So I knew that I needed to get help. And it wasn't until I was around 30 where I really thought, okay, you know, I need this decade to be better than the last. I need to make a big change. And so I just started to make gradual changes. I took this trip to Bali, and sort of inspired by Eat, Pray, Love. That was a big book at the time. And I started doing a lot of yoga and meditating and really starting to pay attention to what was happening in my mind and reflecting on how I'd gotten to that point. And it wasn't until I was in that space that I met my husband, and he was also in recovery, but for drug addiction. And we were just able to meet each other in that space and have the same intention of wanting to change and be better people. And it wasn't until I revealed it to him and he didn't run away, that I thought, okay, I need to get this off my chest. This is something I need to be working on and something I need to be talking about. And that's when I started going to the first 12-step meetings and writing about it and really reflecting and changing, because I had the intention.
The shame that you mentioned, it's it's unfathomable, because the shame in being an alcoholic is the admission, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's become unmanageable. And I heard a quote once, addiction is not the issue, unmanageability is the issue. And when you speak about that shame and the unmanageability, it's, you're really brave. Like, you're one of the bravest people I've met. Where do you go? Where would somebody go that's listening now that thinks they're possibly a sex addict? Or where do you go? Is there?
I think 12-step meetings are a fabulous first step. It's not something that I ended up sticking with, but it's one of the first things I tried. And it's a great place to find like-minded people who've been there. So you go to these meetings and suddenly you have this community where you can reveal these things about yourself that you wouldn't reveal to anybody, that you even sometimes don't want to reveal to yourself. You try to escape from these thoughts and these feelings, but you can bring it there and you can be accepted and even maybe get a nod of recognition from somebody who's been there before. And I think that revealing these things about ourselves and being met with acceptance is a great first step. So 12 steps, you know, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meetings or other support groups that are like that. Otherwise, talk therapy is great if you can take it to a therapist. Those are great first steps, I think.
You know, you said about, you thought most sex addicts were men. And when I was 10, I remember going to an AA meeting with my mom when she had just gotten sober. And it was in our church, the Presbyterian Church in Verona, New Jersey. And I was like, there's a lot of women drunks. Because every cartoon of a drunk is like of a guy. Every TV show is like, hey, how you, hiccup, how you doing? I was like, oh my gosh, like my teachers are here. Like everybody's a drunk in town. It's fascinating. And that honesty that you talk about, I mean, like me with my sponsor, when I mean, it took a couple months for me to go, and porn. Like, that was the one I withheld.
Yeah.
And it was like in July, like, of this year, where I just went, yeah, sometimes the sun comes up when I'm just looking around. It's an isolation. It's with me personally, it's isolating from reality and staying away from the reality, the truth that is life. It's not meeting reality on reality's terms.
Right.
So what's interesting is the power of love, that you loved your husband who was in recovery so much that you, from what I'm reading between the lines here, that you couldn't continue in this relationship dishonestly. The love was too powerful. You couldn't meet love with dishonesty. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, because I had known through most of my relationships before that what it was like to have this really loose, carefree, casual thing with people and a wall between me and other people. I could have lots of sex, but it didn't mean that I knew that person at all. And I wanted to know what the other side of that was like. I wanted to know what intimacy was like, because I could be lying in bed with somebody that I just had sex with and feel 1,000 miles away from them and completely lonely still. And when I met my husband and we started to talk openly and honestly about these things, I thought, oh, okay, well, this might be what love feels like. And I want to know what that feels like. You know, I really felt like I was missing something in my life. And it's interesting you say that about women at the meetings, because so many, I went to a lot of meetings and I rarely met women there either. But yet after I started writing about this, I get so many messages from women who are saying pretty much the same things as men about feeling really lonely and ashamed and isolated and powerless over watching a lot of porn or having a lot of casual relationships with people. And there's no difference between them. The only difference is that women aren't coming out publicly and speaking about it. And I was really hoping to open up the conversation a little more.
Well, you have. Your book really blew my mind. I read most of it in a night, and that's not, you know, something I normally do. I get distracted pretty easily. I was just really fascinated. Like the opening quote, is it Nietzsche? About, there's like actual serial mark. Nietzsche, yeah. Ultimately, it is the desire, not the desired, that we love. Like, that's how you started the book, by that quote. I mean, that blew me away, because it speaks to that hole in us that we think needs to be filled. And I don't think the listener, there's a million subscribers to this podcast, they don't, if I could just tell them anything, it'd be like, you're going to die with that hole. Hmm. Like, instead of running from it, like, hold, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, hold your babies. you can't ignore like a crying baby in a house. You have to hold it eventually until you soothe it. So like addiction, shame, fear, doubt, worry, these are all your babies. Hold your babies until you can soothe them and calm them a little bit. Like it's really fascinating. You spoke about sabotaging incredibly succinctly. The economy of your words in the book really impressed me, because I would have made like a whole chapter about how I sabotaged everything. And there was people you met, I mean, if you're having sex with somebody in a relationship and that's like the number one important thing that you have in common, it's very odd to sabotage the thing that you have in common profoundly. Mm-hmm. And that's that, just that getting off. And that's, I guess, the book really opened up my eyes and my mind and my heart to the primal urge addictions, Overeaters Anonymous, Sex Anonymous. It is incredibly brave, and it's such a harder, more difficult, arduous Lombard Street of recovery compared to just don't drink.
Yeah, and I really wanted to show that in the book, that there isn't one way out of addiction, especially sex addiction, because, yeah, you're not going to give up sex. That just becomes its whole other disorder, and you'll end up cutting yourself off from something really beautiful and, you know, a human impulse, and you don't want to do that. So it really was about me trying to find balance and to say that I still want to be an open-minded, active person in my sexuality, but I don't want to have the shame. You know, and I don't want to sabotage relationships that are fulfilling and could be love. You know, I want to have all of it. I wanted to have a healthy relationship to sex, not just cut myself off from that like you would do with drugs or alcohol.
Are there moments in your recovery where you're having sex with your husband and something in your mind says, this is not the way I should be having sex?
Of course.
I don't know what that's like.
It's
so binary. Booze and drugs are just a binary, like, right. No. And
well, what sex triggers are just going to be everywhere. You know, it could be something as simple as fantasizing. Not to say that fantasy is inherently bad. I think fantasy can be a wonderful part of a sex life. But when I find myself fantasizing about something, that'll cause me to feel ashamed, because shame was such a huge part of my addiction. So maybe I'll start fantasizing about my husband cheating on me, and that really gets me off. It gets my adrenaline going, and I know that it's not really serving me, because then after, you know, we have the orgasm, whatever, then I'm still having those thoughts lingering with us. And then I may be feeling really distant from him and maybe treating him in a way that's not kind. And it's all part of the addiction. I know that my addiction has stepped in here. And it's not something that's always going to be gone from my mind. You know, it's going to always be there. And it's my responsibility to take that to another place and to understand, okay, what's going on here? Is fear taking over? Trying to understand what's happening in my mind. And that's an ongoing effort.
What do you do proactively to keep that from happening? How do you differentiate the day before? I mean, you don't know if you're going to have sex tomorrow, but what do you do today to ensure that if you have sex tomorrow, it's the right kind of sex for you?
If I have a feeling that comes up, like fear, for instance, or stress or some kind of worry that comes up, I don't want to use sex to escape from that feeling. And that used to be a habit of mine in the past. So if something feels really big and scary right now, let's just get off and get away from it and take a break. And that's when the kind of fantasies come into play, or maybe I'll bring porn into the picture. But instead of doing that, I can talk about those things instead. I can say to my husband, okay, this big worry came up. I'm feeling really scared, or I'm feeling really triggered. And I feel like that diffuses the desire to want to take it to a dark place.
It's just communication then.
Right.
That's transparency. It's really like the key to any relationship without addiction is communication. Like,
yeah.
Go to jaymoore.com. This book will be on my website, jaymoore.com. And of course, it's Getting Off, Erica Garza, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction. It's just so good. Also, you can help the podcast the most by shopping through Amazon, through jaymoore.com, like Phil Green, and email me what you bought at morestories3737@gmail.com. And of course, I take requests because Phil Green wants me to do Pacino. Are you going to tell me? That was terrible, Pacino. And there's two Pacino voices. There's the, when he's young, it's real high, like Tyne Daly from Cagney and Lacey. Like, all right. You remember Cagney and Lacey at all?
They're like two lady cops.
And she's like, all right, Harvey. What do you, and like Pacino and Dog Day Afternoon, it's, all right, we're Vietnam veterans. Killing don't mean nothing to us. Attica. Attica. What's under the desk? A squirrel? And then right around like, I forget the movie with Sean Penn where he had like the Jufro. He goes, let me tell you something. Somebody dropped a piano on my back. Benny Blanco from the Bronx. Fuck you. Fuck you. Like, there's two entirely different Al Pacinos. Oh, so are you going to tell me that Phil and Temecula made another purchase using the Amazon banner at jmoore.com? How is that possible? See, how is that possible? I'm getting stuck in my own head. It's true, and it was very easy to do. I simply went to jmoore.com. I clicked on the Amazon banner, selected a Zoom H5 four-track portable recorder and two Audio Technica BPHS1 broadcast stereo headsets, and then purchased them. The latest order is some equipment that I need for a new project that I'm collaborating on with our favorite spy, Pete A. Turner. Thank you for putting Pete on my radar. I couldn't do what I am doing without him. Your pal, Phil Green, Phil in Temecula. Yes, Phil, you are my pal. I always love seeing you, buddy. And Pete A. Turner is an American spy. He's been on the podcast, and he's a friend of ours. He actually records when Corey's unavailable. He comes up from undisclosed location.
Oh, wow.
My ex-father-in-law is like a level 5 classified rocket scientist, and I thought, like, I thought maybe he was a spy. And I go, Pete Turner's coming on the podcast like 2 years ago. I go, he's a United States spy. He's been on 1,000 SEAL missions. He goes, he's not a spy. I go, no, he is. And he goes, about a day later, he goes, your friend Pete, does he have the middle initial? I go, yeah, Pete A. Turner. He goes, oh, okay, yeah, he's a spy. His middle initial. And which one
That's
was
all that
it?
Gave it away.
Yeah, Pete A. Turner. That made him a spy. That like from a level 5 rocket scientist. True car, everybody. Do you have a car there, Erica Garza?
A what?
Do you have a car?
A car, yes.
You drive a vehicle? Well, if you need a new one, you definitely want to use True Car. True Car users like myself save on average over $3,000 off MSRP, and I need a new car. Believe me, I could save some shekels right about now. True Car users, you save on average over $3,000 off MSRP. There are over 300,000 True Car certified dealers that will help you get what you need. There's pre-owned vehicles. That's the route I go. You know, you get a car for like, it's got 120 miles on it, and it's just clack. They just take like 10 grand off.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing. That's what I'm doing. I just hope the guy that had it before you wasn't in the desert like racing dune buggies with it. Like, hey, this caddy runs a little odd. Don't worry about it. True Car, save time, save money, and you will never, ever overpay. Page 88 from Getting Off. I somehow found myself always wanting more from Matt when it was over. It quickly became clear to me that I wasn't just playing the role of an insatiable vixen to make him stay. I was insatiable. That hit me hard because I went through this dual reality where I didn't know what reality was. I was gaslit so badly that I believed the gaslighting. And it seems like you sort of gaslit yourself. Mm. Like, I thought I was a victim for a really long time, and I was sort of a victim, but I'm a horrible victim. And when I lead with it, it's gross. Mm. It's terrible. Like, the trains don't run on time. Like, time management, I would talk to you off mic about it briefly, like, goes out the window. But to come to that awareness that you are actually, like, you thought you were playing the role of this insatiable sex addict, this vixen, this... You're a beautiful woman. Like, you're any guy's like the one that got away. But that awareness is, and that's early, like page 88. Like, that's,
yeah.
Was that the first, oh, wow, something here has to change?
Yeah, I would say that was one of my first long-term relationships. And I mean, sex was a main priority in that relationship. And we watched a lot of porn. And it became pretty unclear to me whether I was performing like the people I watched on the screen or if I really wanted those things. And it was really hard to distinguish between those things. And I think that happens for a lot of young people who come across porn really early, which is just inevitable now with the way technology works. Young people are watching a lot of porn really early and without really exploring on their own what they like sexually. And so they end up, especially girls, end up performing according to what they see on the screen. And sex doesn't become something that you naturally navigate or develop a healthy relationship with. It just becomes about what you think it looks like. And that's, you know, that was a big part of how I approached sex. But also, you know, it became just a big life force for me. I needed to have it all the time. And so, yeah, that was one of the earlier realizations for me.
Hey, this is Jordan Harbinger. I used to host the Art of Charm podcast, but now it's time for something new. The Jordan Harbinger Show. Did you know you can be entertained and actually get a boost in your life at the same time? On this show, we dig into the superpowers of the world's most interesting thinkers and top talents. Then we deliver them to you right into your ears. But I get it. We're not all superheroes. That's why we give you their blueprint so you can live what you listen. After 1,000 interviews, learning 5 languages, and getting arrested in a country that doesn't even exist anymore, I'm now more ready than ever to introduce you to the Jordan Harbinger Show. Listen free to The Jordan Harbinger Show, available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app.
I did a movie once, and when I was arguing with my wife, when I got home from the movie, I didn't know if I was arguing with my wife or if I was acting like I was arguing with my wife, because the movie was written so Wally Wolodarski wrote Seeing Other People. It was about cheating and... a couple, me and Julianne Nicholson, agree to see other people because neither one of us had more than like three sex partners. And I play a Hollywood writer. I just fuck my way through like everything and anyone. And she just has one guy. So it makes her crazy that I'm fucking everybody and I'm going nuts. It's like, it's Seeing Other People, not person. But it was written so well. I remember I was having an argument and it was like, am I arguing or am I acting like I'm arguing?
Yeah, it's interesting.
But you wrote your own script. What really fascinated me in the book was you keep writing about the thing you were going to write, and the book is a byproduct. And I don't know, what was that thing
so
that you were going to work on? Yeah, it is like, what is the being John Malkovich? What was the thing that you were actually trying to write the entire book that you didn't write, that you wrote the book instead? When you were traveling, you're like, I have to write.
A lot of disjointed thoughts.
Did they ever come out? Did you?
I mean, some of those made their way into this book. You know, a lot of them were reflections about my relationships and trying to figure out how to move through the world. And I always used writing as a source of comfort for myself and just to understand how I'd gotten to where I'd gotten to, what happened in the past. It was really a great way for me to reflect and to make sense of what was going on.
You ever write while fucking?
No.
Like both, just get two out of the way at once. Like,
just no.
At a glory hole going, Dear Diary. Of course, I don't know why I went to the Judy Blume Dear Diary route. I could have written anything in my head right there.
Maybe that's a good idea for an essay. I think I'm going to try that.
Like while, during coitus. I'd be interested to see what if anybody has sex and writes at the same time, please email Corey and
I'm not sure anyone's attempted it.
That's talk about meta. You know, when you talk about shame, it's such a valid thing with sex addiction because of the primal urge that I was talking to you about, and we were talking about it's the one meeting a week I go to, which is everybody, like there's Al-Anon, the guy that runs it goes, if you share this at AA, share it under non-AA related news, because it's just this enormous like Buddhist mindfuck of this spiritual path, because the one we have solo is terrible. And every time somebody speaks and they say Sex and Love Anonymous, I look up. I go, who's oh, like drunks, drug addicts, overeaters. Nah, I'm a sex addict. Oh, really?
What's
I like sex.
Like?
What are you? Oh, you're pretty good looking. That's And I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And that's not. I mean, I'm not. I was gonna say I'm not proud of it. It's like, of course I'm not. But it's. I know what it's like to eat. I know what it's like to drink and drug. I don't know what it's like to have sex with that person that's sharing something, and they obviously have. You just. It's really. almost impossible for me to imagine going to a 12-step program with what you went there for. It is impossible for me to imagine. Mm. And I have to imagine when you first said, I'm a sex addict, you felt like the entire room just closing in and staring at you. And that's a tough hustle. That's brave. Do you get, are there sponsors in Sex Addicts and Love Anonymous?
There are.
Sex and Love.
It's Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
What's the abbreviation that I hear all the time?
SLAW.
SLAW.
Yeah.
At SLAW?
S-L-A-A, yeah.
I went to a SLAW in Slauson, man. It was pretty slow.
But, you know, I think across addictions, I think that a lot of the stuff's going to be the same. It's people feeling really ashamed. I think that that would go for even Narcotics Anonymous, and I've never been to Narcotics Anonymous.
But nobody wants to smoke me. Nobody wants to drink me.
Mm.
You know, if I go, I'm Jay, I'm an alcoholic, people don't go, ooh, I bet he's cold. You know what I mean? Like, nobody wants to snort me. It's really, Dr. Drew and I had a conversation a long time ago about when you decide to just hand it over. Like, when I'm running the show, it's awful. I want to do the costumes, the actors, and everybody just doesn't act the way I want them to act, and it'd be a much better play if everybody just did what I said. But when somebody else is running the show, a higher power, I could just sit back and be one of those players. And we were having a really deep discussion about what is the moment, what is the thing that makes you say, enough, and it was disgust.
Mm-hmm.
When you finally reach a like your whole life, people can go, you drink too much, and then one day you look in the mirror and go, what the fuck am I? I'm disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Was that? I mean, we got it to a word. Was that your experience?
I'd say it was loneliness.
Well, then I should keep going. Gee whiz. I don't know what that's like to not be that my whole life. But I think there's a romanticism to loneliness. When we get lonely, the first thing we do is we put on sad music.
Yeah.
You put on like Nick Drake.
Yeah.
Oh, Pink Moon, man. This is great. I'm so down.
And, you know, for a long time, when I was around 12, I was really into grunge. You know, Kurt Cobain was my hero, Courtney Love. And, you know, and then I started reading a lot of Virginia Woolf and like all the Vincent van Gogh I thought was really cool. So it was really this romanticized version of sadness, you know, and loneliness. And I thought
Anne Sexton
was kind of cool for a while.
Did you read any Anne Sexton poetry?
No, I haven't.
It's pretty fascinating. Virginia Woolf just hit my ear like, yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I think that's a big part of our culture is romanticizing these feelings of loneliness and sadness. But then it gets to a point where you can't really romanticize it anymore. It does feel like a big hole that you can't fill. And I really wanted to fill it with something other than an orgasm, you know.
I think that's the biggest fool's errand is trying to fill the hole. I tell people this all the time that I meet. It's that whole, that Thich Nhat Hanh quote. He said that on Oprah and I cried. I was like, am I getting my period? He's a little Vietnamese monk. He's like, the Buddhist's life is suffering, but that doesn't mean, you know, cancer or dying in a fire or watching kids trampled to death by like oxen. He's like, like I said earlier, like it's fear and doubt and worry and shame. Hold your babies. Mm. I was like, holy smokes. The relationships that you sabotaged, do you find yourself now really almost at an expert level an identifier of people sabotaging? Have you become more intuitive?
I guess so, yeah. I could pick it up a little bit. When people start to tell me about their relationship troubles, I could say, oh yeah, I know what that feels like. Oh, it's kind of clear what you're doing. But I would never want to overstep and try to point out other
people. You specifically,
people.
Like a friendship, when you go, like, people try to sabotage. I don't know if they try to sabotage, but if somebody that you're close with try is a terrible word. When they introduced a negative where it doesn't previously exist, that's my most common experience. Usually it's an emotion attributed to me that I have to then defend.
Okay.
And that emotion doesn't exist.
I think I'm better at identifying when I start to fall into those habits again.
If
a friendship is starting to blossom or something and I get intimidated or envious or something like that, and then I put a wall up between me and the other person, and that was a big thing that I used to do in the past. And that's before even finding out who this person really is or what kind of relationship we could have or what kind of friendship we could have. I've already put that wall up, and then it doesn't really work out.
You're healthier than me.
I'm trying
to literally. No, you are healthier than me because I'm so good at identifying other people's, like, oh, he's fucked up, she's a mess, that person said this, this person did that. Like, I can catalog an inventory. And by the way, I never helped more people in my life than when I was my sickest. When I was a mess and there was opera bouncing around my head, I could have buried Tony Robbins at one of his own seminars. Like, nobody would even look at him. I was like, this, bing, you got to do that, pow. You have this, and you're codependent, and you're this. So maybe it's time to tune all that shit out.
Yeah, I think it's a really human thing to try to categorize people and figure people out. But, you know, we don't know anybody's whole story. And so it's really hard to do that accurately. And I think we have a much better chance of identifying it in ourselves.
It really struck me in the book, if I'm going to stick with Matt in that part, like in the late 80s, the pages like 80, 88 through like 90, you said, you told him you needed space. But the entire addiction is isolating, walling, and being alone in space.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a truthful thing when you told him you needed space?
Yeah, it's interesting because I do feel in retrospect that I was quite codependent in that relationship, but still lonely. It was like I was saying before about performing. I really felt like I was an actor in that relationship and not really doing things that I wanted to do or even having the kind of sex I wanted to have. It was all about what I thought it should look like and what a girlfriend and what a relationship is supposed to look like. And that leads you to feel really lonely because you're not being vulnerable or honest, really. And I think I'd really wanted space from my behavior more than anything, more than space from him. I think it was me trying to get away from myself, the person who kept making these poor decisions.
He was the link to the behavior in that specific situation.
In that situation, yes.
You, something in the book that hit me too also was you would have sex with somebody like all night, and the moment they left, you would masturbate. I've done that my entire life. I would masturbate to what just happened.
Yeah.
And it was actually better when they left because I was so in my head when it was happening with like where it became like a problem, like overthinking to the point of like, oh my God, this is awful. And the moment they walk out the door, I'm like, that was amazing. And then alone, I'm actually like jacking off to like what just happened.
Yeah.
That's not healthy. I mean, it's healthy if it's healthy. I think you understand. It's healthy if it's healthy, but it's not healthy when it's not healthy. I don't know how else to explain
it. Yeah, no, I understand that. And that's one of the things I tried to say in the book, too, is that a lot of my behavior could actually be healthy, you know, and in some cases it was. But I think that you have to take a hard look at your decisions and your actions and your motives behind your behavior to see if it's healthy for you in that situation. And that's the big difference there. It isn't to say that watching porn is a bad thing. I don't think that, you know, I think you can have a healthy relationship to porn, but the way that I was using it a lot of times, that wasn't healthy because I was using it to escape. I was using that to feel disconnected from another person, to feel disconnected from my life. And that's not healthy.
Erica, is it safe to say that when you would orgasm was the only time you had a quiet mind?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of what I was trying to escape was all the mess in my mind, the self-doubt, self-criticism.
And by the way, you're not like from a broken home. There wasn't drug addiction in your house. There wasn't like you weren't knocked around by your father. You didn't have like a creepy stepfather to come in when you were sleeping. Like you were, for all intents and purposes, an all-American girl. There's no red flag early that leads you to the path of just, holy shit, what is she doing? And it gets so absolutely crazy where I'm reading it going, Jesus, criminy, this is not hot at all. Like, this is awful. I felt bad. Like, oh my gosh, there's zero red flags. It's just you're born sometimes with a hole. I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah, and I think we need to change the narrative because the common narrative about addiction, especially sex addiction, is that it must be preceded by abuse or some huge trauma. And that's really unfair to people who had, pretty normal upbringings. I had a two-parent home, you know, they cared for me. I felt loved. But, you know, these things happen along the way. I say the biggest change for me was when I was 12, I was diagnosed with scoliosis and I had to wear a back brace. And so, no, that's a trauma at the time. But in retrospect,
cumbersome
yeah.
apparatus. I had a couple kids in my high school with back braces. Yeah, there's no awful. Really concealing that.
Yeah, it was awful. And so that was really the beginning of me feeling really self-conscious and awkward and different from everybody and concerned with what people would think. And I found if I could watch porn and masturbate a lot, that I could just get a break from all of that worry. And it was really effective for a long time.
It's not JFK's back brace. Like John F. Kennedy had a back brace.
Oh, did he?
He had Addison's disease, and that's really why he was assassinated as thoroughly as he was, is because the first shot went through his trachea, and he went, you know, you go to get down. That's not a kill shot. That's a tracheotomy. But his back brace went all the way to his armpits, so he went to lean forward, and he got about 6 inches, and he has to come back up.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he was prescribed, like, crazy amounts of steroids, and the side effects of which were, like, clip speech, is crazy sex drive.
Mm.
But the back brace you had to wear was not presidential.
Right.
It didn't have the official seal.
I think it was called the Boston brace. It was very uncomfortable, though. And yeah, I couldn't really bend or move very much.
I would say what I picked up in the book, Getting Off by Erica Garza, and you have to, this was great about a podcast. Like, if I just go, I put my name on it, it's like the secret code. Like, oh, okay, good. If I do a whole interview and don't say that, they're like, all right, it was nice. But people listening like what I like, so they will go buy the book. And it's a rewarding read. It's profound. And it's the only thing I saw as I categorize and do armchair psychology to you in the book was a sense of, am I Latina? Am I white? I'm in this like El Monte or like some weird part of like LA where it's like
Montebello. Close, though.
It's like Del Monte Green Beans, something Monte Hall from Let's Make a Deal. It seemed like there was a real sense, not you didn't know who you were, but you were uncertain where to firmly just stand as mm-hmm. you. And now certainly you stand as you.
The world's famous wanker, my husband calls me.
The world, yeah, I like the dedication of, this is for all the wankers. I was like, I didn't know you were British. All the wankers.
My husband's Australian.
Oh, he is? All right, good. My brain wasn't, so he can fight, I know. My brain wasn't silent. Insults followed me around all day. You're boring him. Say something funny. Say something interesting. Make him love you. And I just wrote quiet mind. Like, that's my thoughts. If it's not my active thought, it's my subconscious, because I never stop talking. Like, that's, I got prescribed something for like impulse control. And I think it's the relief that a quiet mind brings is so profound. I went to this like sound bath, like this huge sound meditation.
So
it's like,
nice.
What is your intention? What is your wish? You can wish anything in the world for 2018. Just bring it in, quiet mind. Like riches and all that stuff. Like, I just want this to slow down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a great book. I'm going to read from, does it bother you? Like when people read from your book?
No, I really love it.
What if I read like random shit that doesn't make sense? My face went hot. What did you mean by that? Elliot watched sports. What happened? No. So if somebody thinks they have a sex addiction, is a porn addiction separate? Obviously, it's not a sex addiction because you're alone. You're having sex with yourself. And maybe you don't know the answer to this. Is there a porn addiction 12-step or?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't have the answer for that.
Would that go
usually
under sex and love because it's misguided?
It's under the umbrella of sex addiction. Most people will talk about both things at the meetings or one or the other, but always at the same meeting, yeah.
You came out like really sort of physically unscathed from all these adventures, I'll put in quotes. Like it's impressive. I don't know. It's a lot. And the fact that you come out physically healthy, there's actually no reason you should be as healthy as you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like you should actually be, you know, sick.
Yeah.
Physically as well as is that just random luck? Is that, what do you attribute that to?
I would say luck completely, 100%, because I put myself in a lot of dangerous situations. and was not very careful. You know, I didn't use protection a lot of times, and
I would never use it.
And yeah, I came out.
I'm like newly single, and my friend goes, I got all my blood work done. I'm like, my friend goes, but you have to wear a condom. I'm like, I'm 50 years old. Like, it barely works. Like, what? Like, who do you think I'm hooking up with? What would you say is the. I remember one lady when I lived on St. Mark's Place in Manhattan, like 1992. I remember that night. She wore a blonde wig the whole night and sunglasses. Like, it was at some rave at, like, the Limelight. And I remember that night. Oh, my God. If there was ever a time, it was that. Like, I remember the exact person, the apartment, the acts. Is there a specific time and place where you go, holy shit, I should be ill with something?
Yeah. There's one that I write about in the book where I was in Paris for a few months and I met a waiter there, young guy, much younger than me. And I went home with him and we had really violent, rough sex. And I remember afterward, and I didn't have an orgasm or anything. It was just all about the adrenaline rush and, you know, without a condom, doing something that I knew was just unhealthy and bad and scary. I don't know who this guy is. And I remember in the middle of the night, he walked me to the door and said, oh, taxis aren't hard to find. And it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'm outside of Paris now in some suburb I've never been to. And I had to wander the streets.
Some uncircumcised town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say that was certainly a low point for me. Afterward, you know, thinking about it was like, oh, something terrible could have happened and I've somehow come out of it alive.
That wouldn't be the one I would have picked from your book.
That's really?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Which one would you have picked?
There's a lot. There's many.
That one sticks out for me.
Because of him? Because of his character? Because of... You really had condomless sex, mostly, primarily.
Yeah, I don't know.
Something about that guy, you got a sketchy vibe.
Middle of night in a foreign land.
You opened the book with a guy, like, on meth with no teeth on top of you, like, maybe it's not, I added the on meth part.
Yeah.
But he was inebriated, and you commented on him having, like, few teeth. No?
Oh, he had crooked teeth.
Crooked?
I'm trying to remember, who is this meth guy?
His name is Clay, he had a neck tattoo. Yeah. He sold arty photographs to tourists. He's not wearing a condom. I don't care. I'm completely sober. He's not. His mouth is full of crooked teeth. Yeah, I totally added the fact that he was like a meth
I think
guy.
They were all there, but they were just a bit slanted.
I'm like talking my lips over my teeth right now. I'm really glad you wrote this book, and it's rare that I can sit with somebody and tell an enormous audience, this is a really important book, and I believe I'm sure others have written about it, but this one really spoke to me. It's the first one I really read, and it's a world I don't know about. This is really important, and I'm really glad you wrote this book.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is great. Like, this is a rewarding read and really profoundly honest, shockingly honest, and that's the only way to do it. It's the only way to do anything. They're only words, and I say this about stand-up. They're only words unless they're the truth. So if you're not telling the truth, why put pen to paper? And mama, I'm happy that you're I'm really happy that you're happy. I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
I'm glad you were here. So Erica Garza's book, Getting Off. So if you order it, make sure the person caring for your tiny child opens it. And you just, if One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction, there's a book in the mail for you from a company. And A+ doesn't do it justice. It's one of those books where I wish we could redo, like, oh, it's a 10 out of 10. it's a 5-star book on a 4-star scale, Mama. I'm blown away by your talent, and I can't wait to read whatever you write next.
Thank you.
Thank you. Erica Garza, Getting Off. I put my name on it. You put your name on it. Come on, friends. Get with it. Go to jmoore.com, buy the book, and be honest. I guess that's what the overarching message? Be honest.
Definitely.
With yourselves, the hardest. We love you guys. You know I mean it.